shooting from the IL Podcast Studio in the Baltimore, Maryland, worldwide headquarters of Inside Lacrosse. It's the D-Fly and Dixie Podcast, featuring Inside Lacrosse, Big Ten Network, and ESPN analyst Mark Dixon. I am your host, Dan Flint. Before we get started, I want to thank all of you for your support of this podcast and all of the pods here at Inside Lacrosse, including Mondays in the Crease podcast with Aburn and Devitt, and Friday's Weekend Preview podcast featuring Quint Kesenick and Terry Foy. You guys have been killing it, so keep up the good work. Please keep on subscribing, and please keep sharing it with friends who love lacrosse. Dixie, let's get it. Hey, Dix, how you doing? You had a tough weekend. You were traveling during Easter weekend. Did the Rutgers-Maryland game, triple overtime. Bet you love that on Sunday night. Easter, you want to get out of there?
You're totally skipping over the game I did Saturday. Michigan-Ohio State.
Wow.
From the Big House.
Yeah, was that cool?
It was. That place is gigantic. It is, I believe, the largest stadium in the country. 110,000 is the seating. It was incredible.
Nice crowd there?
Yeah, so it was before the spring football game. It was played 10:30 in the morning, and Michigan is Eastern time. Anytime you travel out into a Midwest corridor, you always wonder. But I think ultimately in like the third, fourth quarter, there were about 18, 19,000 people.
That's awesome.
So that set a single game record for Michigan. And ultimately from the spring football game, I think there were like 50, 60,000 people there for the spring football game. But I've never seen anything like it before in my life. So I did the game on Big Ten Network with Mike Wolf, and then I had a flight out of Detroit later that afternoon, but trying to catch a cab in Ann Arbor is like trying to kiss Jesus. You've got to call like 2 hours ahead of time, and plus I'm at Michigan Stadium. I'm in, you know, the epicenter of Ann Arbor, and there was a ton of construction going on, so the main thoroughway into Michigan Stadium was already chewed up from construction. And now you have this huge crowd coming in to the stadium to watch the spring football game. Anyway, Mike agreed. You know, was heading back to Chicago. He drove from Chicago, and he's like, "Hey, man, I'll give you a ride to the airport, no problem." So we're leaving the game as we're leaving the stadium as the spring football crowd is coming in, and you walk out of one gate, and it's just throngs of people walking up to the stadium. Like, both sidewalks are jam-packed, okay? So then we get to the front side of the stadium where Mike was parked, and we're leaving. And then you just see, again, like another entry point, both sides of the street, just maize and blue. And then we're going over to, like, this little overpass, and I just happen to look down, and it's like train tracks. And it's just, like, thousands of people walking on the train. I was like, what is this, the Living Dead, like Walking Dead, for God's sake? It was like zombies coming from every different direction. So it was pretty cool, and it was a beautiful day. When we left, it was hot. Like, it was, it was close to, like, 80, 82 degrees. And Ohio State just played out of their mind that day. They really put it to the Wolverines, you know, a program still on the rise and having a great season out of conference, but in conference, Michigan struggled. So I did that on Saturday. Halfway through that game, didn't feel too good. Started feeling pretty lousy, and went home. And
did you fly back to BWI?
Flew back to Baltimore with every intention of having a great Easter and spending time with the family and my parents and my brother and his family. And that night, 102 fever for me, and just shivering, and it was nasty. I was starting to think of the next day. Obviously Easter was kind of out the window, but thinking about doing the Maryland Rutgers game, that night up in Piscataway, should I make the call to my boss at Big Ten, let him know that, might need to go to the bullpen? But I was like, I'll see how I feel in the morning. And quite honestly, at that point, you already, like, no matter how I feel, I'm doing the game.
Right.
I'm doing the game. So,
but getting there, traveling up there, and then the triple overtime. So what would they do? Like, I mean, I'm sure there's a next guy up, but that list is probably pretty short of who would be a fill-in analyst the day of a game.
Yeah, I don't know. And that's the thing. You don't want to put your leadership in that position. You want to do the games that you've been assigned because you've asked for the work. They've given you the work, and it's yours. And plus, you've done all the prep for it. So, and it's a holiday on
yeah,
top of it.
Yeah, that's true.
So I didn't think there was any turning back. You know, I would have had some suggestions and to try, because that's the thing. You know, you call with anything in life. You know, if you can't do this, or you can't make a meeting, or if you can't officiate a game, or if you, you know, can't do whatever, you not only call and say, hey, I'm not going to be able to make it, but here are some people I think that would do a good job in my place. So I didn't want to think about it. You know, it crossed my mind, but I felt better, a little bit better the next day, enough to play. And yeah, Pete Medhurst and I, we had a great game to broadcast on.
He did
Sunday
a
night.
Real fine job. That was a fun game to watch. Yeah. I felt like that game, I think Maryland might be the best team in the country, and I just was kind of waiting for them to win the game, and they both had so many opportunities. I don't even know how to put it. Like, I was waiting for Maryland to win, yet Rutgers had more, maybe more opportunities to get it done, and then neither team could, and it just kept going and going.
It was, you know, I said it, I think, at the beginning of one of the overtimes, like, this is big boy lacrosse at its finest, and it just felt that way. It was a great crowd on hand at Rutgers. When I pulled up, so I hit traffic that I didn't think I was going to hit on a holiday Sunday. I got to the game probably around 5:45, 10 till 6 for a 7 o'clock faceoff, which is a little later than I'm comfortable with getting to a game. But the people at Rutgers do a great job. Jordan Ozer, their SID. And then the Maryland SID, Sean Ellenby, is a great guy too. So they're the first two people I saw. And right away, I'm like, this is going to be a fun game. This is going to be a good night. And the staff at the security staff at Rutgers are fantastic. They don't, you know, you're walking up with a suit in your hand, because I did not drive up in my suit, shirt and tie. You know, it's hot. I'm sick. I'm like, no, I'm not doing this. So, you know, and I don't have a pass. And they don't harass you. There's certain schools that are like, well, I don't know. Where's your credential? They're like, look, I'm here an hour and 15 minutes before the game, carrying a suit, like I'm doing the game on television. It's, you know, some people are like, well, you need to contact somebody. They're like, hey, man, all right, that's cool. You know,
they recognized you.
Well, it's not that they recognize you. They recognize what you're doing.
Sure.
And I even said, I'm like, look, you could walk me up to the press box if you'd like. And some do. And I totally appreciate that and respect it and understand that. But hats off to the folks at Rutgers. They did a really great job hosting. But, I mean, do you want to dive into the game now, or do you have other business to take care of before we start dissecting all the games?
No, there's just the one other thing I want to do is yeah. There was a major news story at the end of last week. The NCAA passed the legislation that had been on the table for a while, spearheaded by the IWLCA and the IMLCA, about changing the early recruiting rules. And they instituted no contact for any players before September 1st of their junior year. And the shakeup and how that will change a lot of things in the lacrosse world as it currently exists will, you know, still to be determined. But I want to talk to you about that at some point. And
yeah,
because it really affects your oldest son is sort of right in that, where some of his classmates have been contacted already. And now we're just cutting off communication for a year and a half.
Well, he's got teammates already committed.
Correct.
He's got teammates in the process, and you know he's in the process as yeah. well. I was in Michigan when that story broke, and you know I've talked to several coaches over the last few days, as well as club coaches and other folks in the game. So I'd be happy to do a deeper dive into.
Yeah, so
into
we'll
this
do a
topic.
Deep dive in that. And my sister, who has a son who's in the middle of that. He's a 2019 goalie.
Oh, yeah.
And she wanted to know more about that as well, and I'd like to wish her a happy birthday. Today is her birthday, and she's a friend of our podcast, and I know she'll be listening to this. So happy birthday, Tracy.
So she shares a birthday the same week as George Takei, or George Takei.
Oh, my.
George Takei's birthday. George Takei's birthday is this week.
Oh, happy birthday.
Happy birthday,
Mr.
Zulu.
Mr. Zulu, yeah.
All right, happy birthday to your sister as well.
Yeah, she's the best. She's the best. So what a week for the Terps, getting back to our story here. They get a win over Penn State, who was previously the number one team in the country. They go up to Albany in a midweek game, beat the number five team in the country, and then they get a triple overtime win over Rutgers, former number one, now hovering somewhere around like number, I think Rutgers is number 14 mm-hmm. in this week's poll. Still a top Big Ten win for them. You were at the game. You called it. I think the Terps are playing as well as anybody. Syracuse obviously has a great case for number one and at this moment probably deserves a number one ranking. But I think the Terps have got to be one of the favorites, if not the favorite, going into the NCAA tournament.
Yeah, and there's so much going on. There's so many moving parts. And people ask, especially this time of year as we get closer to the finish line, who's your Final Four? Who's going to be in championship weekend? And I honestly don't know. But I do feel very, very confident saying one team I think that will be there is Maryland. And, again, you know, the win over Penn State where they got very shaky goaltending, they win 15-11. Then they go midweek up to Albany, and that was an electric atmosphere. That was a championship weekend kind of atmosphere. Matt Kinnear, I thought, captured it beautifully on a video that he posted to Twitter. Yep. And they had to dig deep to win that game. And then you come back a few days later, third game in 8 days. You've got Rutgers on the road, you know, hungry to avenge two losses to Maryland last year, and then they lost a close one in 2015 up in Piscataway as well. So, and this was a game where Maryland struggled at the faceoff dot. They played a lot of defense in this game, and you know you're thinking they're gassed and they're tired and they probably were, but they stuck it out. They made some stops defensively. I thought Rutgers didn't manage. They had possession and a regulation and the end of the first two overtimes. I didn't think they did a great job managing those possessions. I thought they were a little too primitive with their approach. But that's a very good lacrosse team. Maryland's an outstanding lacrosse team. With respect to Maryland, one guy that I wanted to mention was Dan Morris, who was shaky against Penn State. He saved around 50-55% against Albany. He was non-existent in the first quarter and a half against Rutgers.
And no saves?
He allowed six goals without making a save. The sixth was a dodge from behind the goal by Connor Murphy, attackman for Rutgers, had a fantastic game. He threw this shot on goal that was like had the speed of a snail. It was like he threw a foam Nerf ball.
Change up?
Yeah, and Morris missed it. And I think I said on the broadcast, I was like, if you're a Maryland fan, that's just gross. And he wasn't seeing anything. But then he made one save. Then he made another. Then he made another. At the end of the game, I think he ended up with 16 saves, if I'm not mistaken.
I think he had a career high in saves. Yeah. And I think 16 is the number.
He was great. He was great. And so was Max Edelman for Rutgers. Both of them. That's what made it a great game. Neither team like played conservative in overtime. Both teams played to win. They shot the ball. Goalies made saves. Defenses created turnovers. Transition. It was just a fantastic, you know, game punctuated by the overtime. But Dan Morris was sensational. And that's been the knock on Maryland, is that they have a defense that's been as good as their last couple of defenses. But then when you got by those defenses, you still had to beat a first-team All-American goalie, whether it's Nico Amato or Kyle Bernlohr. Now it's okay. You get by the Maryland defense, and your task isn't as difficult as it has been the last couple of years. But I think Dan Morris is proving that he is not the Achilles heel of this Maryland team. Maybe it'll shake out that way, but on Sunday night he was sublime. He was outstanding, and gotta give him a mention for his handiwork. And like you said, what a week. What a week for the Terps. They earned their chocolate bunnies. They earned their
peeps.
I don't like peeps. I hate
peeps. Gross.
God,
I hate
they're
them.
Disgusting.
I don't really like marshmallows.
I like marshmallow. So growing up, Catonsville Bakery was the bomb back in the day. And they made the authentic marshmallow donuts, like with the real marshmallow, not like just the grainy kind of sugary marshmallow, like the whip. And it's... You know, and I think the only bakery I know that still keeps it real like that is the Fenwick Bakery out on Harford Road in Baltimore County. But anyway, I digress. I hate peeps. They're disgusting and nasty.
I don't like them at all either.
Yeah.
Okay. In another overtime game with big implications, the aforementioned Syracuse Orange got another one-goal win. That's 7 of their 10 wins are by one goal. They beat UNC down in Chapel Hill 12-11 in overtime, make a big comeback. And is this the final dagger in the Tar Heels for 2017?
No, it's not. Carolina's 6-6. They're 1-2 in the ACC. They've got a big game this weekend against Notre Dame. So obviously if they can win that game, they get back on the positive side, you know, over 500, and they take down Notre Dame and improve their seeding for the ACC tournament. Virginia is not going to qualify for the ACC tournament. You know, Carolina is going to be in it. So they have Notre Dame in front of them. Then they have the ACC tournament. Plenty of opportunity for the Tar Heels.
Now looking at Syracuse, they just keep getting it done. You know, they're going to be the top seed. They're 5-0 in the ACC. They're finished with their ACC season. They have a fun game against Binghamton this weekend.
The Bing.
And so it looks like they might get a rematch with North Carolina in a couple of weeks, unless Carolina can beat Notre Dame. They might slip ahead of them in the ACC standings at 2-2, and Notre Dame would fall to 1-3, which is hard to believe that Notre Dame would be 1-3 in the four seed in that.
Sure. Game. Welcome to lacrosse, Division I lacrosse in 2017. Yeah. But, you know, there's a couple things that were working against North Carolina. One, it was Senior Day in Chapel Hill. Two, it was the last game that was going to be played on Fetzer Field. And then three, they were down by 5 goals at one point, 10-5. And they entered the fourth quarter down 10-7. And Carolina scores a man-up goal to go up 11-7. And then Syracuse closed the scoring out with 5 consecutive goals, the game winner, off of a man-up in overtime. Now, there's a little bit of controversy, I guess, at the end of regulation, the face-off. There's been some video circulating of a Syracuse player palming the ball and then throwing it forward into space. I tell you, man, that just does nothing but stirs up and amplifies a conversation to get rid of the face-off. So,
completely get rid of face-off?
Absolutely. The noise on getting rid of the face-off is louder than ever right now. And the last few years, the conversation has been, should we get rid of the face-off? Now the conversation is starting to turn to, how do we get rid of the face-off? It's getting bad. So, guys, I mean, I'm not pointing fingers, you know, but knock it off. It's just, you're only going to hurt the game, you know, with this kind of stuff. And it's just not good. And, I mean, I don't want to sound like, you know, like a school marm here or anything like that. But it is getting to those type of noise level of let's really examine the face-off and figure alternatives to facing off after every goal.
That would be a radical departure from what the game looks like right now.
It happened back in the, I believe, the late 70s, and it was, you know, goals were scored, and then it was cleared afterward. Everybody says it was terrible. Everybody said it was awful, no good. You know, but that was lacrosse back in the 70s. Would it look better here in the, you know, in 2017 and all that? I'm not sure. I can just tell you there two things that are popping up the most in terms of conversation for rule changes. One is putting the substitution box back to 10 yards. It's currently at 20 yards. Put it back to 10 yards to create more transition. That's a very real conversation that folks are having.
I thought that's what it was meant to do.
It was
making it bigger.
It was, but now you can, you know, when you sub guys off, you've got your pole already basically in the box,
right.
You know, so he just has to take a few steps and he cuts off transition or any defensive substitutions. I like it as a referee because it just kind of spaces things out and you can see more. You don't really want to be focus too much on the box because there's a lot of crazy things that go on in there. But we have been charged as officials in 2017 to police it a little bit more. You know, not go in the box like we used to in the old mechanic, but, you know, go near it because coaches have a tendency to come onto the field. And obviously last year the incident with Princeton and Brown led to the dismissal of the Princeton coach, Chris Bates. You know, officials took that to heart and said, maybe we could have prevented that had we policed the box a little bit better. And then the other, again, but then the dominating topic to potentially eliminate the face-off. I mean, you think about it, and I didn't mean to go off on a tangent on the face-off, but so much time is spent on the faceoff. Think about it from a coaching standpoint, okay? Preparation during the week for an opponent, they spend an inordinate amount of time. And I can't speak for every coach. This is just conversations I've had with coaches that I know and cover and converse with. They spend a ton of time trying to figure out what the other team does on the faceoffs. And in particular, what's their move? What's their advantage? What are they going to? And then they take that information and they talk to the powers that be in officiating. You know, hey, do you know that Dan Flynn from Green Shirt University does this? You know, blah, blah, blah. And there's a lot of conversation around that. Then you get to game day, right? And you have your certification with the coaches. You know, you get, coach, can you certify your players properly with Kirk Corning rule? Yes, I can. Who are your captains today? Who's your in-home? Okay, any questions for us? Yes, on the face-off, 9 times out of 10.
Yeah, you mentioned
on the face-off. So then you end up having, and it's fine. You know, the officials are there to listen and converse, and it's a partnership between the officials and the coaches. So then you spend all that time talking about the face-offs, right? Then you have a pregame meeting with just the face-off men. So it's just gotten to the point where it's taken, and every rule cycle, face-offs are adjusted. And no matter how hard the officials try, and you can look for it all day, sometimes you just can't catch the stuff that's going on. Anyway.
Possession is 9/10 of the law. And if you don't have the ball, it's really hard to score on offense.
No question. And as we discuss the games, that's going to become a common theme. And it has been a common theme all year. So, hey, that's just what I'm hearing. Nothing's written in stone. Not throwing stones. I have plenty of friends out there who are facing off, have faced off, teach face-offs, whatever the case may be. Just giving you the current climate of the NCAA amongst coaches, amongst officials, amongst leadership in the game, as to like what the conversation is starting to sound like with faceoffs.
And just getting back to it, I had mentioned Syracuse 5-0. Obviously, they're only 4-0. They've beaten all of the other four opponents in the ACC. Duke is 3-1, and they're finished. So they have locked up the second
finished in ACC play.
In ACC play,
regular season play.
They will host the tournament next week and be the number 2 seed. And it really, this game, Notre Dame and North Carolina this weekend, really determines who's the 3rd and 4th seed, who will play who in that game. So that's a big game coming up. All right, switching gears a little bit. Let's talk about the leaders in the Ivy League who are 5-0 in the Ivy League and have the number 1 seed locked up in that tournament. It looks like the Yale Bulldogs have won 7 in a row, and they beat Brown 18-12 this weekend, and they are playing some great ball these days.
They are, and I go back to the end of March where I covered a game for ESPNU. It was Princeton, Yale, and you know, Yale was kind of, they were scuffling. They were off to a rough start. They lost 3 of their first 4 games, or 1-3, and then they win a 2-overtime game against Fairfield, then they smoke Cornell. But talking to Andy Shea leading up to that Princeton game, he's like, you know, I'm really nervous about this game. Princeton's going to score a lot of goals, and we're not playing good defense, and we're not getting, you know, consistent goaltending. So they win that game 16-13, and I think that was really a game that gave him a huge shot in the arm. You know, Ben Reeves started to look healthy after dealing with an early season injury. Eric Scott is a tremendous player, and he keeps getting better and better. But now they're getting contributions from more people. You know, Matt Gaudette is a good looking freshman, and he had a great game against Brown. The other thing is they did go with they have made a goalie change. Phil Hufford has stepped in and is really playing some solid lacrosse for Yale, and he's been a difference maker. They just weren't getting a ton of consistent goaltending. And now they, I think Yale feels like they're getting it, and the defense is improving as well under assistant coach Andrew Baxter. So this is a team that continues to improve, continues to excel. They've proven they can score a ton of goals, and they're fun to watch. It's all about defense and goaltending. If Yale can keep that consistent, they're going to be in great shape. But I mean, Ben Reeves, what else can you say about this guy? I mean, 56 points at this point in the season. He was fantastic against Brown, like I mentioned, and he's a handful. But I mean, again, this team faces off well. They're getting better defense, better goaltending. They can score in bunches. So, you know, in a league that's looking more and more like one bid as the weeks go by, Yale looks like, you know, they got the top seed for the Ivy League tournament, and all roads to the NCAA tournament through the Ivies lead. They go through New Haven, and Yale's in the driver's seat right now, and they've really put it together over the last couple weeks.
Dix, there are no longer any undefeated teams left in Division I lacrosse.
What?
Actually, in Division III, Tufts and Salisbury lost this weekend, too.
I saw that.
Yeah, Drexel beats Hofstra 13-12. They were down 11-6, and they score 6 or 7 straight goals. Mm-hmm. Seven goals in the fourth quarter, including 3 in a span of 46 seconds or something like that. And they come back and win 13-12. Upending Hofstra for the first time all season. A great win for our boy Volks.
Yeah, no question. Beating his college teammate Seth Tierney, yeah. You know, another friend of ours. So huge win for the Dragons. And Hofstra just had everything going for him in the first half, and it just it didn't work out in the last 30 minutes. So, but no one likes to lose. That's for darn sure. But oftentimes, when you get that loss, it takes a little bit of pressure off. So maybe now Hofstra doesn't have the pressure of being the only undefeated team in Division I, being far and away the number one seed, you know, going into that Towson game on April the 29th. Maybe it takes a little pressure off. I don't know. Maybe I'm just full of it. But Ryan Tierney continues to play incredibly well, 5 goals, freshman. Did a great job. And, I mean, you look at Cole Schaefer for Drexel. I mean, he's a kid we've been talking about, you know, really 2 years ago, and haven't heard a whole lot about him. But he had a great campaign when Drexel got to the NCAA quarterfinals just 2 years ago. So big win for Drexel. An unbelievable when you think about it. They're down 10-3. And then to come back and hold Hofstra to 2 goals. I mean, 2 goals over the last, gosh, what was it, 13, you know, 28 minutes?
Yeah.
Somewhere around there.
And that's at Hofstra, too. That was on the island.
Yeah. That was in the island. Yeah,
well, you got to give Jimmy Joe Granito. What a name. The goalie for Drexel. 15 saves in the game.
And so we got to learn about Jimmy Joe Granito. And we played at Loyola originally. And then transferred to Drexel. And that is probably the only Jimmy Joe that you're ever going to meet that's from Connecticut. I mean, you think Jimmy Joe Granito, you're like, okay, he's from Southern Virginia, maybe, yeah. The Carolinas, you know? And you're like, no, he's from New Canaan, Connecticut. You're like, that's very, very interesting. Interesting also in this game was the penalty situation. Rutgers. Well, I always say Rutgers when I talk about penalties. Hofstra had 6 fouls in the game, and Drexel had 0. So no man-ups for the Hofstra Pride. And, you know, when you're trying to get back into games and you're down,
you got to play clean.
Got to play clean, and the man-up is essential. And actually, the game winner with 1:02 left, Jacob O'Donnell, got the game winner.
Now, I didn't see this game. But you can be sure you don't get any when you're a road team on Long Island. You don't get any calls. So they must have played a nice, clean game to get those penalties and get it done on the road with a great comeback. So congrats to the Dragons on a big win for them.
They put themselves now into the playoff picture for the CAA.
Yeah, key win. Dix, another team you want to talk about? Furman gets a 13-8 win over High Point, and Furman is 4-0. SoCon, and setting themselves up well for May, late April and May run in the SoCon.
So I had a chance to see Furman back on March 7th. They lost to Penn State 12-10. And look, Penn State didn't play the greatest game that day, but they still proved to be a handful. And in talking to Richie Meade before that game, so they entered that game, they were 1-5. They're 1-6 after. And that included coughing up a 5-goal lead to Vermont in the home opener, a loss to Sacred Heart that was really tough to take for them, and a loss to North Carolina 7-3, where actually that game was a one-goal game going into the fourth quarter. So it would have been really like a roller coaster season for the Paladins and Coach Richie Meade. And he said, you know, we're just getting ready for conference play. Man, are they ready? I mean, they are 5-0 in the SoCon. They've got VMI left on the schedule, which they will be favored in that game. And then they'll play who I think is the best team in the SoCon, Richmond, at Richmond. But when they played Penn State, they had a couple of guys that just really jumped out. And the first player, and it is a mouthful, it is their goaltender. He's
Alex
a freshman.
Van de Bovenkamp.
Van de Bovenkamp.
Yeah, he played in the Committed Academy. It was outstanding.
There
and
you
has
go.
Having a really nice season as a freshman starting in the pipes.
But he was really, really strong. He didn't play particularly incredible that day, but he was still somebody that you looked at. Lou Jovino is a middie that they have. An attackman. Really good shooter. They have a couple other guys. David Williamson was impressive. Just guys that you're watching this team and you're like, really? They're 1-5? You know, about to go 1-6 in a loss to Penn State. So I like the job Richie Meade is doing in Furman. It's taken probably a little longer than he thought it was going to take, but just they're a really good team, and now they're starting to put it together in conference play. William Holcomb's another guy that jumped out, as being a really good player. They've got some really good middies, really good athletes, good Dodgers, and that kind of thing, and they're seemingly putting it together at the right time, undefeated in the SoCon.
That's a fun league, the SoCon.
It is, absolutely. I'm a huge I like all the teams, to be honest with you. Air Force with Eric Saramet, everything he's done with them. High Point has really struggled this year big time, but when you face off around 30%, that's what's going to happen. You never have the ball. You just play a ton of defense. Richmond, I think, is a team that they're the favorite to win the SoCon AQ, and they could even, they can win an NCAA tournament game this year. There's no doubt. They played some teams very tough and got some nice wins as well. So, the SoCon is it's a fun, like you said, it's a fun league. It's an up-and-coming conference for sure.
Dix, I want to get your thoughts on your top five and who you think are the best teams in the country, and we'll do the Maverick media poll. But first, I want to talk about Sideline Swap. Mm. Sideline Swap is where lacrosse players buy and sell their gear. Find deals up to 70% off on heads, shafts, helmets, and more. Or snag unique gear from the colleges and the pros. The MLL starts this weekend. Did you know that?
I do. I was actually supposed to do the Bayhawks opener on Saturday night, and then I got a different assignment from the Big Ten Network, so I had to get out of that game. But Bayhawks play the Lizards.
Yeah, that'll be a great game.
Yeah.
Lots of incredible MLL stuff on Sideline Swap.
Nice.
And that's where people should go. So Sideline Swap also lets you sell old gear simply and securely. List in seconds, and they'll send you a prepaid shipping label when it sells. Visit SidelineSwap.com today to get started. That's Sideline, SWAP.com. Sideline Swap. Dix, we finally had a number one team that actually holds on to the number one ranking for 2 weeks in a row. It's the first time since, I think, the second and third weekends of the season, the second and third polls
right.
of the year, that we had a team hang in there. The Maverick media poll this week at number five. Albany holds at number five, even after losing a midweek game to Maryland. Duke's number four at 10-3. Number three is Denver at 9-2. Maryland is number two at 9-2. And Syracuse is 10-1 and holds down the number one spot. Hofstra was like the big free faller from the poll. They were number two last week and fell down to number 10 after their loss to Drexel. And we welcome a couple teams. I don't know if they've been in the top 20 before. BU and Providence. get in the Maverick media poll for maybe the first time in school history.
No, I thought BU was in. Remember, BU started 5-0, 6-0.
Yeah, you're right.
So early season, they were around like the 17, 16, 15 area.
And apologies, Terrier fans.
Yeah, way to go.
and Villanova jumps in the top 20. They kind of slide in there this week. Been there before.
They have.
But they're sort of the movers up.
No, welcome Providence, and that's a team we definitely should talk about. They clinched a berth in the Big East tournament with a huge win over Marquette. They play great defense. They are very, very stingy. Chris Gabrielli doing a great job in Providence. That's a big deal. That's a big deal for Providence to make it into the Big East tournament. And they're incremental steps, but that is a program making some positive.
There's
a lot
of really good young coaches who are in their third, fourth, fifth year at their program who are really starting to make a difference, and he's one of them.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, you talk about young coaches right off the bat. Dan Shimati at Richmond is the one that pops into my mind first and foremost. And there are plenty out there, but that's one. When you talk about like new program, this is a success that they've had, just not in the not only in the SoCon conference, but in the out of conference as well. You know, wins over Duke.
I mean, they're an NCAA tournament team.
They are consistently now.
Yeah,
you know. And there's plenty more out there.
So let me hear your top five. Who do you got at number five this week?
The Maverick Inside Lacrosse media poll took my poll this week, basically. And
just worked
used it.
So you got
and used it.
Albany at number five, then Duke, then Denver, Terps at number two, and Cuse.
I've been asking them to use my poll now for however long I've been voting, and they finally took my poll. But yes.
It makes it a lot easier to tally all the votes if we just took yours.
Pretty much.
And it would be right every time.
Yes. And then just to keep you on your toes, I would throw in just like, you know, Glassboro State or something as number three to see if you guys are paying attention and catch that.
Like Green Shirt University.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, throw something in like that.
What's the matter, you? So that is my top five. Albany, Duke, Denver, Maryland, Syracuse.
Got it. Okay, Dix, it's time for our Epic IL Committed Academy Freshman of the Week.
Let's get it.
We had... Nicely done. We had four candidates this week. We a couple of guys, like, it's always attackmen, some middies who have nice games, but those guys put up the stats that are hard to go against in an online poll. And our winner this week is Joe Madsen, St. John's attackman. He's had a career high five goals in their 18-12 loss at Denver. His previous high was four goals last week, so he's hot right now. He leads the Red Storm in points and goals. He's having a fantastic freshman campaign. He got 48% of the votes. Almost half of the vote went to him. And we had like close to 500 people vote this week. Nick Griffin, UMBC defenseman. One ground ball, one cause turnover in their 7-6 huge win over Binghamton. And he was part of his own defense that really shut down the Bearcats. So he got some love. Maybe our first poll that was in one of our online polls. No pun intended. Then Jackson Morrill had four assists in their 18-12 win over Brown. He's a Yale attackman. And Ryan Naraki from Providence, who we just talked about, a middie, had a one goal and one assist in their win over Marquette. Those were our four candidates. Congratulations to Joe Madsen, the Epic IL Committed Academy Freshman of the Week. Again, the Committed Academy is a transformative three-day developmental camp for committed Division I players, boys and girls. The girls' event is July 7th and 9th in Baltimore, and the boys' event is July 28th to 30th, closes the summer out here in Baltimore. And if you are a committed Division I player, you need to be at this.
I'd love to attend it. I'm on vacation that week, though. Second year in a row, I'm on vacation the last week of July. If you could switch it around for me.
A lot of people are on vacation.
Right. It's a great event. I got nothing but positive vibes last year.
Yeah, it was great. It really was cool.
It was fantastic.
Thank you. Dix, we start talking about this earlier. I want to get into a little bit more. You know, we talk about the Committed Academy. It's for committed Division I players. And the NCAA made a major move last week, voting to stop early recruiting. It's been something that the coaches have complained about and really haven't been able to control it themselves. They needed NCAA legislation to sort of enforce it. And what the rule states is that no prospect can be contacted by any Division I coach in any way prior to September 1st of their junior year. And this includes phone calls, emails, texts, none of that. You can't talk to them at a tournament. You can't talk to him after a high school game. You can't even have an unofficial visit where the athletic department or any school official or administrator is involved in the tour. So you could go to a game or you could walk around a college campus, but it can't have any participation from any member of the athletic staff or school. So it's a sweeping legislation. It's effective immediately. And we mentioned before, your son is a freshman in high school.
No, he's an eighth grader.
My bad. Still, he's
part
of
this. But he's in the wheelhouse.
There
he's
are kids
in the
who,
wheelhouse.
Yeah. So there are kids who are in eighth grade, ninth grade, 10th grade, who have been down the road a little bit, talked to coaches, been to prospect days on college campuses, have had unofficial visits, but now their contact has to cease with any coaches. I want to get your perspective on this as a guy who coaches club lacrosse, a guy who officiates, a guy who broadcasts, a guy who formerly played, and also as a parent. What is your what's your take on this? Where do you think it goes? You said you've talked to some coaches about this, and where do you think some of the gray areas are going to be? What do you think the role of club coaches? A lot of people think that will it's only going to increase the power and the participation in the recruiting process of club coaches, which could be a good or bad thing. Doesn't matter. But I'd love to get your stance on this.
That's a lot of meat on the bone that you just threw my way. So I'll do my best. But everything you just mentioned about the student athletes, whether they're eighth, ninth, 10th grade or whatever, their involvement with the college coaches' involvement with, it's all been legal. It's all been up until now. And there's a couple of things. One, I think people were surprised that it passed. And if you look at this thing from, a few months back, it was dead in the water. Then it was revived. And even with that vote, set to take place, it happened last week. Most of the folks I talked to are like, there's no way it's going to pass. There's no way it's going to pass. It's just, there's no way to regulate it and enforce. And the NCAA has bigger fish to fry. The NCAA is all about football and basketball, revenue-generating sports. Why would they care about lacrosse? But sure enough, it passed. Not only did it pass, the other really surprising thing is that April 26th date that they put in. And then even with that April 26th date, the legislation is like in place now. So that took everybody really off guard because I think that the thinking was we'll get, August 1 or a date in August is going to be when it goes into effect. So, okay, we have this summer.
I heard as late as 2 years from now it might
oh,
not
really?
Be in
yeah,
effect. The, it could the take a while for it, like Brexit. It might take a while for it to kick in.
So with it, but going back to thinking it was going to be in August of 2017, that gives coaches the entire summer to evaluate and, host and all that kind of thing, recruit. Yeah. And then there'd be a mad rush of 2020s, 2021s, being their graduation years. Those are rising 10th and then rising 9th graders. But that, at least in theory right now, is not the case.
Yeah, so you mentioned the April 26th date. So what he's talking about is the legislation passed on April 13th or April 14th, at the end of last week. And because it is not considered a controversial ruling that, it doesn't affect, it's like a budget thing and it doesn't affect any like literally laws, that it can go into effect immediately. Otherwise, new legislation that gets passed by this rules council has to go in front of a bigger board on April 26th. This will not. So yes, it was a bit of a surprise and took a lot of people off guard that it was effective immediately and actually caused some confusion about the two dates and what would happen. Some people thought that, as you said, there could be maybe a rush of commits. Now, kids can still commit. There can still be a third party or a go-between, and we think that probably will become club coaches or recruiting directors of clubs that will become more involved in this and say, I can talk to this coach on your behalf. This kid is interested in this particular school or this type of school. Do you have a spot for him? And then a kid could commit without ever talking. And there was one in particular, I think he was an eighth grader from Manhasset, Long Island, who committed to Michigan over the weekend. and after this legislation passes. So his offer was probably on the table. He's allowed to make a commitment. There's nothing against that. But the school just can't have any contact with him now until the junior, September 1st of his junior year. So 3 years from now, just basically. So there's a lot to digest about this. We had a nice podcast, a round table with Terry Foy, Jeff Shannon, Dan Ayburn, Josh Davey, that should go live maybe before this even. But I encourage you to listen to that.
Define nice.
It was a long discussion. One thing G-Shan said that I hadn't heard, because the NCAA, as you mentioned, like lacrosse seen as a, you know, a non-revenue sport that isn't football and basketball, that maybe they're using this as a test market, as a test case for this type of early recruiting legislation, that there aren't as many eyeballs. There's only 72 Division I schools, that's counting St. Bonaventure, to play men's lacrosse. If they wanted to try this in soccer or volleyball or some other, you know, women's sports, men's sports that have more schools participate in, use lacrosse as a test to see how this works out. And I think that is where something I hadn't considered, I think, could very well be the case and why it did get passed as it did.
I really don't have any background on that, really can't speak to that. But I think in talking with people and trying to flesh this out, everybody has their positives with it, but there's also a lot of negatives with it if you talk to people. So let's start with the positives. So a lot of people feel like this takes pressure off of kids and their families to make a decision at 13, 14 years old, 15 years old as to where you're going to go to college. Let's be clear as well. This, nothing's official. Really,
yeah,
you know, everything is a verbal. So schools can pull, kids can decommit. You know, there's a lot that can happen between verbaling as a rising ninth grader and then your, you know, fall of your senior year, whatever the case may be. So many people feel like that's a positive. The other positives are it basically, people might think that it evens the playing field from a financial standpoint of families. So, you know, Dan Flynn's parents have a lot of money, so they can send them to this showcase and that showcase and this prospect day and that prospect day. And, you know, someone else, you know, Joe Smith from wherever, his parents don't have those resources, so he can't get to those. He can't play for that big club. You know, he can't do this, that, and the other thing. So a lot of people feel like it might even the playing field in that regard. There's also negatives to it. And the other thing is, another positive is, college coaches now might feel like they can truly get to know a kid and watch him develop, watch him mature, not only as a player, but as a student. And you just have more time. And then the other thing with the coaches is, now they can just manage their active roster of 40, 45, 50 guys. They don't have to worry about 10 guys in this class and 10 guys in that class and, you know, basically trying to manage 90. Now you're managing 40, 45. So those are some of the positives. Now, negatives. Some people feel like this is the further softening of America. And what I mean by that is kids that are developing earlier or show talent earlier or getting opportunities that other kids aren't getting. It feeds into the everybody gets a ribbon kind of mentality. Everybody gets a trophy kind of mentality. I know that's not the case, but again, I'm just giving you I shouldn't say it's not the case. I'm just telling you what people are some things I've heard over the last few days. They think it's and they think it also is twofold for club coaches. One, club coaches don't want to tell a kid he's not good enough to play at his chosen school or desired school because they're afraid that they're going to lose that kid and lose that money that comes with that kid. And the other thing is that the club coach now becomes the main go-between of that player and family and that college coach. And let's just say, for whatever reason, the coach is dishonest, or the club coach, you know, he's dishonest or not straightforward or has an agenda or something, you know, is he giving that family the accurate information? Is he giving that college coach the accurate information? Is there any nonsense going on? So that's where, you know, several college coaches I spoke with said now it leaves it in the hands of, well, what could be construed as some shady club coaches. So those are kind of like, those are kind of top level things. What I see happening and what the chatter is now of how this is going to look moving forward, a de-emphasis on early recruiting. And what I mean by that is at a particular event, when you're looking at rising ninth graders or rising 10th graders, instead of a school sending two or three of their coaches, now maybe they send one. Maybe they don't even go all together. Maybe they just completely wash their hands of it. There'll be more prospect days and or slash prospect camps at these schools. So let's say Dan Flynn College typically does one prospect day in a calendar year. Maybe now you do three or four. You get your commits to come on campus. You can talk to them because you're coaching them, right? And also get prospective players to come. So instead of it being maybe the you're still going to have the big tournaments. You're still going to have the big, you know, the big events, but maybe coaches, instead of going to them, now have their own things back on campus. And they're going to, again, they're going to rely heavily on the club coaches. I had several coaches say to me two things right off the bat.
College coaches.
One, they're all meeting with their compliance departments this week to figure out what all this means and what has to be done. And a lot of them use the word loophole. Where are the loopholes? What are the loopholes? And
I think it's going to be the grayers are going to be around these prospect days and camps, sure, and having kids, because you can't have an unofficial visit. You can't meet with a kid. You can't talk to them. But if they come to your camp or your prospect day,
yeah,
and they're on your campus, it's the opportunity to do that. So go ahead.
Yeah, and you know, and you're going to have, you know, Dan Flynn wants to come visit my school. Okay, I can't show him around, but I'm going to educate the person that is going to show him around. I'm going to make sure that person is on board and understands the importance of this recruit. And you know, it's not back to the future fully, but it's more back to the future. And I've talked to other folks, and they use the word underground. You know, they feel like this is going to go underground in a lot of ways. I don't know what that's going to look like or what it's going to, you know, feel like. But so that, I know that you asked a very, very broad question.
Yeah, sure. It's tough to tackle in one, you know.
It is. And we're going to have to wait and see how this thing plays out. I can tell you that the kids, you know, the kids who are 13, 14, 15-year-old, they're disappointed. They're actually like, man, no, I wanted to commit this summer.
Yeah.
I was going to go to this event and that event. I was going to play in this tournament and that tournament. And, you know, Coach so-and-so was going to be here and he was going to be here. And they're
yeah, this is what I was really hoping to get from you. And that's probably a real honest assessment.
Sure.
That, again, your son and his buddies are in this.
And I'm not saying it's my son and his buddies but I'm just saying just overall.
I could see how kids would be.
They're,
you know,
bummed.
They were with this summer or the next summer. This is when this was going to happen for them.
Yeah.
Playing. So, yeah, I could see how they would be.
They've sat and watched.
Now you got to wait 2.5 years for this to happen.
They've sat and watched guys that they play with, play against, look up to, get there. And that's what they're working towards. And now they're like, oh, I got to wait? Really? I got to wait? So, you know, and then there was a really good article. Harry Alford, who used to be the goalie at Maryland, put together a piece. And one point that he made that I thought was really poignant was, and I don't mean to laugh, but I'm thinking about back to when we were in school. Now coaches have to have the official on-campus visit. And you know how out of hand those can get sometimes. So with the unofficial visits, you know, a kid's coming maybe in July, perhaps August, when things are settled. You know, there's not a lot going on. Not a lot of people are around.
Comes with his parents.
Not hanging out.
And he's 15 or 16,
yep,
and not 17 or 18.
So now you're going back to the future again. You know, you're having these 17, 18-year-olds on your campus, staying over for the weekend. you know, there's a lot of things that can happen. So I thought that was a really good point made in that piece by Alford, that talked about that headache that really hasn't been existent for coaches on the level of yesteryear.
And there are so many legendary stories of people's recruiting visits. This is whole movies like Johnny B. Goode about his recruiting trips and, you know, Texas high school football player. Yeah, it'll be an interesting.
If anybody what knew went down with Dan Flynn's visit to Johns Hopkins, how they were able to get their punter of the future on the football team.
I was thinking about you. You're talking about Michigan's spring football game and just the people just in troves of people just walking across. That's what it was like going to like a Hopkins football game back in the early 90s. You just saw people coming out of the libraries and the dormitories just streaming across the Homewood campus, just headed towards Homewood Field.
It was literally the Walking Dead coming out of D level of the library. No question. No question whatsoever.
D level. Oh, my God. We're laughing because I don't know if anyone really understands. Like at Johns Hopkins, the library, the main library has...
It's underground.
Yeah. And it really is where... Three quarters of the campus is in that library on any given day at some point, including I would spend a ton of time in there studying. And there,
I never made it to D level. I spent plenty of time in the library, probably more so than some of my friends and teammates, but I never, ever
C level. C or B level.
I was B or C level, was as deep as I would go. I went to D level one time, and it was maybe a week or two before I graduated. And I was over at PJ's, and I had a good time. And me and a couple buddies were like, hey, let's check out D-Level before we leave this campus. And we were we rolled in there like bulls in China shop. And we
imagine.
Oh, boy. It was we lasted. I mean, it seemed like we were there for like 2 hours, but I'm sure we were only there for like 5 minutes.
Did you read any books while you were in there?
Read any books. Yeah.
Hopkins is so nerdy. Wasn't there like a campus like hangout or little pub or something on campus called D-Level?
Yeah, the rat.
But there was something called D-Level. That's how
probably,
nerdy
it yeah. was. Yeah, probably.
But yeah, like you'd go in there on a day there'd be a game and it would be packed. You'd go in there. It did it.
Go in where? D-Level?
Any part of the library.
Oh, any part. Yeah, yeah.
I mean, there's just...
Well, that's why Hopkins is one of the most renowned,
the intense focus on
in
studying. It's crazy. You'd be like, don't you people know? It's a beautiful spring day. There's a lacrosse game today. Get out and go... No,
so,
library's packed.
So, as we talked about previously, I work in pharmaceuticals for Merck, and I do oncology, and there is a doctor that I used to call on. I say used to because he's in a territory that I used to manage. I don't manage it anymore, but he graduated from Johns Hopkins in 1995. I graduated in 1994. Really nice guy, super guy. Big Maryland basketball fan, big Ravens football fan. Just, you know, would go and on appointments and we'd chat and talk about sports and all that other kind of thing. And then we connected the dots that we both went to Hopkins together. And I was like, I can't believe that we never crossed paths in school. Like, he's the kind of guy that you would want to hang out with. And he's like, dude, he goes, I spent my whole 4 years at D-Level. I spent every day at D-Level. And I was like, that's why you're the doctor and I'm the salesperson. You know,
exactly.
That sums it up.
Okay, Dix, it's time for our give and go. But before I start that, there's some breaking news here at Inside Lacrosse. Posted on InsideLacrosse.com. The NCAA has released the locations for the next four NCAA championships.
I saw that.
Yep. So the next.
Lay it on me.
In 2019. So the next.
So 17, 18 is in Foxborough.
Correct. In 19. And 20, it will be at Lincoln Financial Field in Philadelphia, one of my favorite places that the tournament has been and will go. And in 2021 and 2022, Rentschler Field, East Hartford, Connecticut.
Wow.
Wow is right.
Fairfield, right?
I guess so. Fairfield will be the host. That is correct.
Okay.
Drexel will be the host when it's at Lincoln Financial
Field. Lincoln Financial Field. So back to, is Rentschler Field college campus?
It isn't. I believe that's where UConn plays its football games, Rentschler Field in East Hartford.
Okay. What's the seating capacity?
It's probably like in the high 40s.
Okay.
I don't know that. Again, it might be in this article. But But it leads us into our give and go. And it is your three favorite places to watch a lacrosse game.
Okay.
And it can be anything. Pro, college. Let's stick to pro and college. Let's not put high school into it. Now, you've been to a lot more stadiums than I have.
Yeah.
And probably a lot more. You've traveled a lot more recently than I have. I went to a lot when I was working at Hopkins and Towson and Penn. I went to a lot of games and a lot of places, but that was a little while ago. So my three, you think about yours,
mm-hmm.
and my three.
Go ahead.
I love going down to UVA and Klockner Stadium.
Okay.
Yeah, I really like the way the nice grass field seating with the – they have those little soccer dugout thingies. And then there's the hill on the side, and there's always a good crowd there. And usually Hopkins, you know, I would go to watch Hopkins play Virginia most of the time, and they would have some classic games. So I love that place. Second, the Dome, Syracuse. Not friendly to Hopkins or Hopkins fans or many other people's fans, really, because they usually win. But it's a really cool, unique place to see a game. I remember the first time I went in there, the field didn't look right to me. It doesn't have a crown on it. So
right.
Most fields have some type of crown to help drain, and mm-hmm. Dome didn't have that. And it kind of blew me away seeing that for the first time. And my number one place to watch a lacrosse game, you're going to be shocked by this.
Yeah.
It's Homewood Field.
Wow.
Yeah. There's no place like Homewood. And it's just if – I'm not the only person who said this, but if you got to watch a game, it's the mecca to go see a game. And there's just the atmosphere on campus. We had a one of our listeners, a friend of the pod, who asked a question. He was going to his first lacrosse game at Hopkins. He wanted to know, like, what he should do. Like, what's a full day? Where does he go? What's he do? And you said, make sure you stop by PJ's Pub. Make sure you get a walk around campus if the weather's nice. And check out Homewood Campus. It's really pretty. And do some tailgating, walk around. But get into the game a little bit early. Make sure you can soak up some of the atmosphere inside the stadium. So those are my three. So, again, Klockner, the Dome, and Homewood Field.
I thought you were going to say, like, wherever Bruce Springsteen is playing is my favorite place to watch a lacrosse game. Yeah, the Meadowlands.
That was a cool one. We did the Big City Classic. That was really cool.
Was it?
Yeah, running out Giant Stadium or the Meadowlands Stadium to host lacrosse games was pretty darn cool.
Well, one of my fondest memories of watching lacrosse and as a broadcaster was 2003, and that was the first NCAA championship weekend played at a professional football stadium, and that was at Ravens Football Stadium in Baltimore, and that was awesome. It was a lot of fun. Hopkins smoked Syracuse that day to get to their first national championship game since 1989. That was Kyle Barry, Kyle Harrison. They destroyed.
It was like Adam Doniger.
Adam Doniger.
Bobby Benson on that team?
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. So they advanced to the championship to play Virginia, who swamped Maryland in the second game. And I just remember it was great. I was doing the radio with Larry Quinn, and you're in the Ravens broadcast position, and it's open air. So, like I'm buying hot dogs and, you know, just talking to fans and, you know, just having a great time. And so that was a great memory. And I enjoyed watching lacrosse games in subsequent years, subsequent championship weekends and some lacrosse events from now known as M&T Bank Stadium. But in terms of college venue, three would be Hofstra. Hofstra is a great place.
Shuart Stadium.
Great place to broadcast from, and just great atmosphere. The quarterfinals a couple years ago when Notre Dame beat Albany, that was a tremendous atmosphere. I wasn't there in person, but I was down in the studio in Charlotte for ESPNU watching it, and that was great. And Hofstra, you know, they love their lacrosse at Hofstra. And so Hofstra Stadium would be number three.
Shuart Stadium will be the host of one of the quarterfinals sites from 2020 through 2022.
They deserve it.
It'll be there every year. It'll be almost a permanent home on Long Island.
Yeah, that's a great place to watch lacrosse. I also like Navy Marine Corps Stadium.
It's a great spot.
That's great. You can get close. Bayhawks games are there, and they do a fantastic job of the tickets aren't that expensive. It's always kind of energetic and lively. They do draw a nice crowd. I think, you know, their ownership does a really good job of treating the fans to a first-class experience. Much like you, the Carrier Dome is fantastic to broadcast from. Sight lines are great. even when there's only 7,000 or 8,000 people in there, it's loud and it's energetic and frenzy. And the other thing is, you can always, like, you know, it's like, you know, when a snow's coming or the rain's coming, you know, when a Syracuse Orange run is coming, you can just feel it brewing and sense it, smell it, almost taste it. So the Carrier Dome for me is a great place to watch a game. And much like your number one, it's Homewood Field. I mean, as a broadcaster, the broadcast position has not changed. The press box has not changed.
They've put more stuff in it.
They put more stuff in it, but it's still the same structure.
It's less seating.
Yeah. So, but it's Homewood Field. I mean, just take this past Saturday when Hopkins hosted Penn State. I think the official crowd was like 4,200. Still looked like it was 8,000, 9,000. Yeah. You know, when it's people line the fences and. You know, that's just a great place to watch, you know, to watch college lacrosse. And back when I was growing up, my father used to take my brother and I to UMBC quite a bit when they were in Division II, and great battles with Hobart and Adelphi, and you know, they won a couple national championships at D2. That was always fun to go out to UMBC Stadium and watch lacrosse.
But who was the coach then?
It would have been Dick Watts.
It was Al's dad, right?
Al Watts' dad, Dick Watts. Yeah, Dick Watts. I mean, they Marty Cloud, Dave Quattrini, Russ LeClaire. Gosh, who else do they have? Way, I think, Rick Way. I mean, it was like just names. It seemed like we went like every Saturday, every other Saturday, and hear the same guys over and over again.
Awesome.
That was great. But yeah, my three would be Hofstra, Carrier Dome, Homewood Field.
And I'm finding out Rentschler Field, where the championships will be, host 38,000 fans.
Okay.
So it'll be a tough ticket, which is what some people have been saying. Like, maybe we make it into a smaller venue than an NFL stadium and put a little premium on the tickets.
Sure.
And make it a harder to get and create a little bit more demand.
Fill
the stadium up. You TV guys, you just want a filled stadium. That's it.
That's right.
All right. Thanks, Dick.
Games.
Yeah, that's our give and go. You know the games will be good.
Sure.
Hey, let's talk about what to watch this week. This is a huge pivotal week for a lot of the conference. Regular seasons are coming to an end, and there's some really good games that are stacked at the end. In the Patriot League this week, Army 6-1, Loyola's 5-2, and they meet up at Army. That should be a fun game to really decide probably the number one seed in the Patriot League tournament.
Absolutely. And the Patriot League was turned upside down a little bit this week with Navy, who had really just having a tough season, knocked off Army before almost 13,000 fans in Annapolis. And then Loyola losing to BU, you know, put the Terriers back into the conversation. So that'll be Patriot League is wide open right now.
And another Patriot League game that's key, Holy Cross is at number 19, Boston University. They're mm-hmm. both 4-3 in the Patriot League and jockeying for that third seed.
Mm-hmm. In
the Michigan at number 8, Johns Hopkins. Hopkins homecoming.
Yep.
Heading out there? Or you got a game?
No, I will be working for Big Ten Network that day.
Number 16, UNC at number 6, Notre Dame. We talked about that one.
Big game.
It's for decide like third and fourth seed in the ACC tournament next weekend.
Hopkins, the win over Penn State, Gerard Arcieri had 3 faceoff violations 7 minutes into the game. And much like the way Ohio State used their faceoff violations against Hopkins and then took advantage of the extra man, Hopkins did the same thing. And Michigan is they've struggled mightily in Big Ten play. So, you know, Hopkins will be at least probably a 4-goal favorite, 5-goal favorite going into that one. And then UNC Notre Dame, the Irish had off last week, so they could rest up a little bit, get healthy, and they've got a North Carolina team coming off of that heartbreaking overtime loss, coughing up an 11-9 lead with about a minute and a half left to Syracuse. So they're going to be hungry.
Number 11, Yale, is at number 5, Albany. In a game that will be really fun to watch.
No question. And if Yale could get that win and then they falter in the Ivy League tournament, that's a W that could get them, you know, an at-large berth or put them in a position to get an at-large berth.
Number 20, Providence at number 3, Denver. Both teams 3-0 in the Big East.
Yeah, and Providence is riding high right now, knocked off Marquette, feeling good about themselves. They qualify for the Big East tournament, and let's see how they do in the Mile High City against Trevor Baptiste. Denver took down St. John's this past weekend for the 500th career win for Bill Tierney. So congratulations to Coach Tierney.
He's a legend. Congratulations. In the Big Ten, number 2, Maryland at number 7, Ohio State.
Big game, and that game will be in the shoe. A game 2 years ago that Maryland stole in the regular season, and then they met in the semifinals of the Big Ten tournament, and Ohio State knocked them off. So, you know, Maryland coming off the 3 games in 8 days, we know who their superstars are, Matt Rambo, Connor Kelly, Tim Muller. Ohio State, just you never know who's going to have the day. This past weekend, Eric Fennell and Trey LeClaire were the damagers against Michigan. The week before, Jack Dzinski came out, 4 goals and 3 assists, 7 points against Johns Hopkins. I mean, they've got Johnny Pearson. But that is going to be Jake Withers, the faceoff man for Ohio State, has been on fire the last 3 weeks. Absolutely dominant. He, in my opinion, is the best faceoff man in the Big Ten. And how will Maryland manage that matchup? And if they have to play a ton of defense, what will the officiating be like?
And finally, number 14, Rutgers at number 9, Penn State. The loser of this game falls to 1-3 in the Big Ten.
I have got that game Sunday night on the Big Ten Network. I can't wait.
I ended with that one.
This could be Thunderdome. Two teams enter, one team leaves. This is lacrosse's equivalent of a steel cage match. And Penn State has dropped 2 in a row to Maryland and Johns Hopkins. Rutgers lost to Hopkins, beat Michigan. The heartbreaker, I mean, just a heartbreaker against Maryland this past weekend. Both these teams are going to be excited and ready to play. The game they played last year at Rutgers is one of my favorite games ever to do. It was, I think Rutgers ended up winning 14-12, but it was up and down, back and forth the entire night. It was really fun to watch. I expect a lot of the same is coming Sunday.
All right, you can catch Dixie doing that game Sunday night on the Big Ten Network.
7 o'clock.
7 o'clock. He is Mark Dixon. You can find him at Dixon Lacrosse on Twitter. I am Dan Flynn at D_Fly, or you can email me at dflynn@insidelacrosse.com. Be sure to listen to all the podcasts on our network here at Inside Lacrosse. Enjoy the games. We'll talk to you next week.
Bang, bang. Brown Mound, you ask me again, I'll knock you down.